take it, but I'm always willing to listen. Something to keep in mind. This is a small community. We look after each other. Somebody like you comes scratching around, nosing in our business. That doesn't sit well. No one's objected so far. Not to your face. We're too polite for that, but I've heard grumbles. Of what sort? Understand, this is not coming from me. I'm repeating what I heard. I won't hold you accountable. What's the rest of it? If Violet hasn't been found so far, what makes you think you're going to get anywhere? Seems nervy to some. It takes a certain amount of nerve to do anything in life, I said. This is a fishing expedition. I may not get a bite, and in that case, I'm gone. You think if one of us knew where she was, we'd tell you after all these years? I guess that would depend on why she left and how protective you felt. Liza Mellencamp believes she's out there somewhere. She claims she doesn't know where, but she sure doesn't want to be responsible for Violet being exposed. Suppose it's true, he said. Suppose she left town like a lot of people think. Suppose she's made herself a whole new life. Why track her down? Believe me, she suffered enough. If she managed to escape, then more power to her. Daisy hired me to do this. If people have a problem, tell them they should take it up with her. My personal opinion? She's entitled to any information I can find. Assuming you come up with anything. Right. But you know what? The years work on all of us. Secrets are a burden. If someone's teetering on the brink, all it takes is a nudge, which is one of my jobs. He pushed his plate back and took out a pack of cigarettes. I watched him light up, extinguishing the match with a puff of smoke. He kept his cigarette in one corner of his mouth, squinting against the smoke as he leaned to his left and extracted a money clip from his pants pocket. He peeled off a 10 and put it by his plate. Well, I wish you luck. Meantime, I got business to take care of. One more quick question. You think she's dead or alive? I really wouldn't care to say. Happy travels. Thanks. As soon as he was out the door, I took out my index cards and scribbled down as much of the conversation as I could capture off the top of my head. I glanced at my watch. 7:45. With luck, I could get a call through to Daisy and catch her before she went to work. I grabbed my shoulder bag and moved through the dwindling crowd. I walked back to my room, intending to do a final quick walkthrough before I checked out. I slowed as I approached. My door was ajar. I stopped in my tracks. Maybe the motel maid was in there cleaning the room. I moved forward with caution and used the tip of my finger to push the door open to the full. I did a slow visual survey and then stepped inside. Everything was just as I'd left it, at least to all appearances. I had no luggage, so if someone had broken in, there was nothing to search. The bed was still rumpled, covers thrown aside. In the bathroom, my damp towel was where I'd placed it earlier, over the rim of the tub. I paused in the doorway between the two rooms and let my eyes do the traveling, object to object, surface to surface. Nothing seemed to be disturbed. Still, I knew I'd locked the door securely because I'd tested the knob right after I'd pulled it shut. I walked to the front office, my room key in hand. The parking lot was now only half as full, but I didn't spy anyone who seemed to take an interest in me. Mrs. Bonnet was at the desk. I told her I was checking out, and while I waited for my credit card receipt, I said, "Did anyone come in this morning asking for me?" "No, ma'am. We don't give out information about the paying guests. Were you expecting someone?" "No. When I got back from breakfast, my door was standing open, and I was curious." She shook her head, shrugging, unable to enlighten me. I signed the slip. She handed me the carbon, and I put it in my bag. I walked back to my car, which was parked in the slot outside my room. I unlocked the door and slid under the wheel, tossing my shoulder bag on the passenger seat. I turned the key in the ignition, wondering for one fleeting paranoid moment if I was about to be blown sky high. Happily, I was not. I backed out and then shifted from reverse into first. The car seemed to waddle when I accelerated. Even with my limited knowledge of mechanical problems, this was not a good sign. I drove forward another couple of yards, thinking I'd run over an object and I was inadvertently dragging it behind. The waddle was still there. Puzzled, I put my foot on the brake and opened the door, leaning to my left. I shut the engine down and got out. All four of my tires had been slashed. Chapter 18. Chet. Friday, July 3rd, 1953. Chet Kramer sat in his four-door Bel Air sedan, smoking a cigarette, a pleasure he relegated to the end of his day. The windows were cranked open, including the two wing windows, which he'd angled in hopes of capturing fresh air. He loved this car. The Bel Air series was top of the line, with four models, the two-door sport coupe, the two-door convertible, and the two-door and four-door sedans. All had automatic transmission, radio, and heater as standard equipment. His was two-toned, the top woodland green, the lower portion sun gold, a combination he'd personally selected for himself. The colors reminded him of the green and gold of the old Lucky Strike cigarette pack. When World War II came along, the government had needed the titanium used in the green ink and the bronze used in its gold, so Lucky Strike had abandoned the color scheme in favor of a white pack with a red bullseye. When he first started smoking, he'd been attracted to Lucky Strike because of the slogan, "Be happy, go lucky," which seemed ironic in retrospect. He hadn't been happy-go-lucky since the death of his father in 1925. Recently, he'd switched brands, thinking to disassociate himself altogether from the notions of happiness and luck. The new Kent cigarette, with its micronite filter, was billed as the greatest health protection in cigarette history. He wasn't sure why he was concerned about protecting his health, but he didn't think it hurt to cut down on tar and nicotine. He popped open the glove compartment and took out the sterling silver flask he'd inherited from his dad. He kept it filled with vodka from his office supply, and he used it to fortify himself before he went home each day. He preferred rye whiskey, but couldn't afford to greet Livia, smelling like a loaf of delicatessen bread. He unscrewed the lid and took a slug. He felt the heat of the liquor going down, but it didn't dissolve the ache in his chest. He checked the clock on the dashboard. 5:22. By 6:15, he'd be having dinner with his wife and daughter, after which he thought he might as well go back to work. He'd taken advantage of the July 4th weekend to advertise a firecracker of a sale. During special promotions of this sort, he devoted long hours to the dealership as a matter of course, and now that he'd fired Winston, he'd have to shoulder the kid's load, such as it was. He saw work as a blessing, a way of immersing himself in the here and now. At the moment, he was only going through the motions, knowing it was easier to stick to his routines than to try to make sense out of what had happened to him. He'd parked, facing south on New Cut Road, halfway between Highway 166 and the point at which the road construction ended. The Tanner House was dead center in his line of vision. To his immediate left was a gravel road leading back to the old Aldrich packing plant. The swing-arm gate across the entrance was padlocked and had been for years, so the spot was the perfect place to unwind. The midsummer air was humid. In his rear-view mirror he could see a breeze undulating across the fields, ruffling the dark green leaves of the sugar beets. A tractor trundled by, hauling a bulldozer on a low-boy flatbed, the only traffic he'd seen for the past hour. While he watched, the driver did a clumsy K-turn and positioned his rig in preparation for unloading. Chet took another slug of vodka, dwelling on the trivial while he tried to assimilate the grand. Wednesday seemed like a lifetime ago, though it was only 2 days. He hadn't known how depressed he was until Violet cracked through his life like a lightning bolt. She'd been dazzling, and for the first time in his life, he'd been engulfed by desire. He felt like she'd doused him with gasoline and set him afire. The minute she proposed a drink, he'd seen where she was headed. Dazed, he'd followed her out to his car, tossing an explanation to Kathy as he left. He couldn't remember now what he'd said to her, some lame excuse she'd accepted with a shrug. For once, he'd been grateful his daughter was such a dunce. Despite her moony crushes on movie stars, she was sexually backward, too naive to recognize the chemistry that had flashed so suddenly between Violet and him. After leaving the dealership, Violet abandoned all talk of his buying her a drink. They got in his car and she directed him to the Sandman Motel, which was two blocks away. He hadn't noticed it before, but Violet was clearly well acquainted with the place. She'd instructed him to check in as a single, under an assumed name. She waited outside while he registered as William Durant, which was actually the name of the man who founded General Motors back in 1908. He was afraid the desk clerk would catch the joke, but she didn't bat an eye. Having deceived her to that extent, he invented a fictitious home address and a detailed explanation of why he needed a room. He was more imaginative than he'd thought. He went on lying through his teeth, flirting with the girl until she blushed a becoming pink. He paid for the room, took the key, and returned to his car. Violet was gone, but he spotted her at the far end of the parking lot, leaning against the wire fence that surrounded the swimming pool. She waited until he'd parked outside the room, and then she stepped on her cigarette and ambled in his direction, taking her sweet time. She must have known what a picture she made. Sunlight shining on her red hair, her figure fully defined by the tight purple sundress. He was trembling at the prospect of having her. When she reached him, she held out her hand. He dropped the key in her palm and watched as she unlocked the door. He followed her in, marveling at his calm. He had no idea what she expected of him. She set the key on the table and turned to him. "I bought you a bottle of vodka, but then forgot the damn thing and left it at home. Sorry about that. I thought you might need a couple of belts to soothe your nerves."
"You planned this?"
"Sweetie, do I look like an idiot? I've seen you watching me. You think I don't know what's been going through your head?"
"Our paths hardly cross."
"No fault of mine. If you weren't so straight-laced, I'd have done this ages ago. I got tired of waiting for you to make a move, so here we are. Surprise, surprise."
"But why?"
She laughed. "Don't underestimate yourself. You're a good-looking guy, and you're sexy as hell. I'll tell you something else. You've been working too hard. I can see it in your face. When's the last time you cut loose and had fun, for God's sake?"
I don't know what to say."
"Who asked you to talk? Did I say anything about chatting, Chet?" She was making a little joke of his name, but he found he didn't mind.
She sat down on the bed, patting the place beside her.
"Look at you, all tense. Come over here and I'll help you relax."
He crossed to the bed, moving as though drugged. When he reached her, she rubbed the palm of one hand against the front of his pants.
"My, oh my, this is going to be good."
She'd been gentle and sweet, guiding him through a process so highly charged and novel, he felt his heart would stop. Nothing with Livia had ever prepared him for such heat. Violet thought his shyness was a riot after all the bullshit he'd laid on her earlier. She'd said, "Big, tough guy," in a way that made him laugh. How could she mock him and make him feel good at the same time? Later, under her patient tutelage, she'd murmured,
"Right there, sweetie. Oh, that's nice. Keep doing that."
She seemed to enjoy bossing him around, inflicting occasional tiny jolts of pain that sent his pleasure soaring into the stratosphere. She liked being in charge, liked making him groan at certain little tricks she had. They made love for an hour, and at the end of it, she pulled away from him, laughing and out of breath.
"That's it for you, stud."
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing's wrong. I got a scoot, that's all. Daisy's parked with a neighbor, and I can't be late picking her up.
Foley's a psycho when it comes to how I spend my days. Plus, my neighbor's a bitch, and I wouldn't put it past her to mention it to him. How are you doing?
He laughed. Fine. I can't move.
Good. I'm glad. Shows I treated you right.
He remained stretched out, naked, on the bed, as she pulled on her underwear and slipped her dress over her head. She crossed to him and sat down on the edge, holding her hair off her neck so he could run the zipper up the back of her dress. Once her dress was zipped, she continued to sit with her back turned to him.
I know people think I'm cheap, but this is not about that. What happened this afternoon is just between us, something both of us want. I know I could have gone about it some other way, but you wouldn't have agreed. You'd have been worried about Livia, worried about Foley, worried we'd get caught. I don't want you to think badly of me. I knew if I didn't push, we'd never get here.
She turned to look at him, and he could have sworn she was on the verge of tears. He reached up and touched her face. She laughed, self-consciously, dashing moisture from her cheeks. She pulled the sheet over him.
Gotta cover you up, or next thing you know, you'll get me going again.
He started to rise, but she put a hand on his chest.
No, no, you stay there. I like your hair all tousled and standing up on end. It looks cute. You ought to wear it like that all the time.
Don't leave.
I have to.
Give me 10 minutes more. An hour. Better yet, let's just stay here together for the rest of our lives. She thought about it briefly.
30 seconds, but that's it.
She sat down again. She took out a cigarette and lit it, passing it to him.
You're full of surprises, you know that?
He touched her bare arm, marveling at the silky feel of her skin.
You're beautiful. I feel beautiful with you.
When can I see you again?
That's not such a hot idea. You know it's dangerous.
I like risk. I never knew that about myself until you came along.
That's enough out of you, stud. I'm out of here.
She kissed her index finger and pressed it to his lips. She put on her sandals and got up, tucking her purse under her arm.
How about tomorrow at noon?
I'll have less than an hour, but that's the best I can do. Don't you want me to drive you to your truck?
I can walk. It's not far, and it's better this way.
She left, closing the door behind her. He could hear her footsteps fading on the pavement. He wasn't sure how he'd survive the hours until he saw her again. When he arrived home late in the day, after his usual meditation out on New Cut Road, he thought he'd be weighted with guilt. But just the opposite was true. He was happy. Something akin to affection resurfaced, and he sat at the dinner table glowing with goodwill. Livia had made jellied salmon for supper, possibly the most disgusting thing he'd ever eaten except for her chicken livers. Nonetheless, he found himself watching her with a kindness rare for him of late. Where had that gone? He thought of himself as a good man, but he realized that as far back as he could remember, he'd been angry and cheerless. Now, that had been erased. Even Kathy didn't seem as tedious. He was secretly amused, knowing she'd never dream what her old dad had been up to. He could hardly believe it himself. The transformation from dead to half-dead to reborn. If she happened to mention his leaving with Violet, he'd invent something on the spot. And he knew he'd get away with it. His was a whole new world. That it included lying, adultery, and certain acts that were biblically forbidden only made it all the more titillating. He asked for a second helping of canned lima beans, hoping he wouldn't laugh out loud at the images still floating through his head. He endured Thursday morning with his eye on the clock. At 11:50, he left the dealership, saying he was going out to lunch. When Kathy asked where, he said he hadn't decided yet, but he'd be back in a bit. Feeling worldly, he checked into the same room at the Sandman. It was all so easy now. Violet arrived, and moments later,
in a flurry of discarded clothes, feverish kisses, agonizing groans, and grabbing at each other. They were both naked and lying on the bed. Her breath smelled of red wine and cigarettes, but he knew better than to ask what she'd been doing at the moon so early in the day. What difference did it make? The sex was even better this time, which he hadn't believed possible. Already, he felt comfortable in his skin, sure of himself. This wasn't the lovemaking of strangers, but the intimacy of two adults. Violet could be rough, and she brought out the bawdiness in him. She was also outrageous, using language that sometimes shocked his staid sensibilities. She could be tender as well, in ways that made him want to weep. Afterward, they shared a cigarette like lovers in a movie. He couldn't get over this new sense he had of himself. Violet was tucked up under his arm, her head on his shoulder, face tilted back slightly so she could look at him. He looked down at her, saying, "What?" She laughed. "How did you know I had something on my mind?"
"You're not the only one with telepathic powers."
"Oh, that's good. I like that." She was quiet, smile fading. He gave her shoulder a shake.
"Come on, out with it."
"I was thinking about what you said yesterday. You know, spending the rest of our lives in this room. That was sweet. That made me feel I was special to you, not just a cheap piece of ass."
"Hey, enough. Don't say shit like that about yourself."
"Well, it's the truth. You know my reputation. I'm a wild child. I live fast and loose. But you know what it's about. Under all the trashy talk and screwing around, I'm completely numb, like I'm already dead inside. So at least when I'm crazy drunk and out of control, I feel like I'm alive. Does that make any sense?"
"Jesus, you've just described my life. I don't show it the way you do, but it's exactly the same with me. You think I'm happy because I make a lot of money and live in a nice house? Doesn't work that way. All my life I've been busy taking care of other people. This is the first thing I've done for myself. When I said that about spending the rest of my life with you, I meant it."
"Thanks. That makes me feel good."
She seemed hesitant.
"What happened yesterday? With the car? I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have taken it. I know I was wrong putting all those miles on it. But something came over me. It was like I'd just gotten out of prison and the world could be anything. The sunshine and the ocean. It was just so beautiful flying down the road. I had all the windows cranked down and my hair was whipping across my face. I took it all the way up to 40 miles an hour.
Shit, Violet, don't tell me that. You'll give me a heart attack."
"Well, it was an amazing experience, and I have you to thank."
"And for this?"
"Yes, for this."
He was quiet for a moment. "You know, I can make it happen."
"Make what happen?"
"The car. I can set it up so it's yours." She laughed.
"Oh, come on. Bullshit. You can't do that. Are you nuts?"
"I'm serious. Tell Foley to come talk to me. If he shows up tomorrow morning, I can make him a deal."
"Foley doesn't have a dime."
"I know, but we'll work something out."
"You'd do that for me?"
"Yes."
"You're not just pulling my leg."
"I'd do anything for you. I mean it. I'm crazy about you."
"You don't have to say that just because we ended up in bed."
"You don't know what you've done for me. Everything's different now. I've changed."
"Not changed at all. You're finally yourself."
"Tell me you'll see me tomorrow," he said. "Otherwise, I'll never make it to next week." She was quiet again, making a study of his face before she formulated her reply.
"All right. Tomorrow at 4. I've got something to take care of first, so you gotta promise you won't get your undies in a wad if I'm late."
Friday at 3:45, he checked into the Sandman. On Wednesday afternoon, when he'd registered the first time, he told the desk clerk a pipe had broken in his house, badly flooding the downstairs.
He spun the story off the top of his head, never realizing he'd be checking in again the very next day. Thursday, he told her he expected the repairs to be underway, but the contractor stood him up. She'd been sympathetic on the first day and skeptical the second. Today, she was snippy, saying if he was going to check in again, why not just keep the room instead of using it for an hour, checking out, and coming back the next day? He hadn't realized she was keeping track. He felt compelled to elaborate, talking about the smell of mildew, having to put all his furniture in storage. The phone rang in the midst of his recital. She picked up and turned her back to him. She went on chattering with some friend, until he realized she didn't intend to listen to another word. He took his key and left. What a bitch. He was a respectable businessman. It was no concern of hers what he did or didn't do, or with whom. He wasn't sure why he'd even bothered to explain himself. There were other motels. Next time around, he and Violet could find someplace else. He returned to his car and drove the length of the parking lot and parked outside the room. On the way over, he'd stopped at the florist's and bought Violet an armload of flowers that he wanted her to see the minute she entered the room. He took the bouquet with him and let himself in. They'd twice been in room 14. This was room 12, and he noticed it was quite a bit shabbier. Not that she'd care. He knew the car was already in her possession, because Foley had driven it off the lot at 10:30 that morning. He'd come into the dealership at 8:45, and Chet had made him a better deal than he had any reason to expect. He'd been jovial through the process, knowing he'd be bedding the guy's wife by 4:15. He'd despised Foley previously, but now he pitied him as well. He was too doltish and too much the brute to appreciate what a rare and precious woman he had. She was clearly more than he could handle. Young, sensual, beautiful, spirited. Foley'd tried controlling her with his fists, and all he'd done was to drive her away. Chet knew how to treat a lady, and he had the wherewithal to do it right. He'd already formulated half a dozen plans for getting her out of Foley's house and stashing her somewhere close. At first, he thought he'd have to leave Livia, which he was perfectly willing to do. A divorce would be messy and painful, but he was 47 years old and entitled to happiness. Of course, his daughter would be upset, but kids were resilient. Everybody said so. Kids sensed when their parents were unhappy, and you didn't do them any favors papering it all over and pretending everything was okay. Better to have it out in the open. On further reflection, he wondered if his initial impulse was wrong. The more he thought about it, the more he realized how cruel it would be to put Livia through that. The public humiliation, the vituperative shouting matches, not to mention the reduced circumstances divorce would entail. After 15 years of marriage, she'd be devastated. Better to take the high road and spare her the stigma of divorce and abandonment. His relationship with Violet was his to bear, and he'd shoulder it like a man. He'd checked the classified ads for apartments in Santa Teresa and spotted a rental he thought would serve. Clean and attractive, with an ocean view, it said. He could drive down to see Violet every chance he got. He'd fill her life with riches. Clothes, travel, anything she wanted. She might resist at first, not wanting to be beholden, but now that the Bel Air was hers, she'd realize how far he was willing to go. He filled the ice bucket with water and arranged the flowers, already fantasizing what was coming next. Compared to Violet, he was inexperienced, and that was humbling. At the dealership, he was always on top, figuratively speaking. But here, he yielded, allowing her to do with him as she would. Violet was the boss, and he found himself giving up all power to her. The change was restful, a possibility that had never occurred to him. With Livia, he sometimes had to talk himself into making love. He had his physical needs, but it was just as easy to take care of them himself. With Violet, he was charged, half out of his mind in anticipation of her. Oddly enough, he'd caught sight of her earlier in the day. Shortly after noon, he'd driven into Santa Maria to do his end-of-the-week banking, forgetting that the bank would be closed for the 4th of July. He'd parked near the Savoy Hotel, and as he was passing the tea-shop window, he chanced to look in. There sat Violet with her little daughter Daisy, and Liza Mellencamp having a gay old time of it. He smiled at how happy she looked, probably because the car was now hers. He was tempted to tap on the glass and wave to her, but he thought better of it. From now on, in public, he'd act like he didn't have a clue who she was. 4:20. She was late, which she'd warned him about. At 4:26, he checked his watch again, wondering if something had gone dreadfully wrong. If she'd been unavoidably delayed, there was no way she could call because she couldn't be sure what name he'd used when he was checking in. On the off chance Foley had arrived home unexpectedly, she could hardly excuse herself and go use the phone. Foley was paranoid as it was. Between bouts of lovemaking the day before, she'd let slip some of the things he'd done to her, the threats, promises of retribution if he ever found out she'd betrayed him again. Chet was appalled, but she'd shrugged it off as though it was no big deal. "But I'll tell you one thing," she'd said. "Next time he comes after me, that's it for him. I'm out." 4:29. Chet could feel anxiety roiling in his gut. What if Foley had gotten wind of their rendezvous? Chet didn't dare leave. If she finally showed up and he was gone, she'd be furious. At 4:36, he heard a tap on the door. He pulled the curtain aside, half expecting to see Foley with a gun in his hand. It was Violet, thank God. He opened the door, and in she strolled without a word of explanation. He waited, thinking surely she'd offer an excuse. Errands, Daisy, heavy traffic on the road. "Jesus, what happened? You said 4:00. He knew his tone was accusatory, but he was so relieved to see her he couldn't help himself. "That's all you have to say to me? I risk life and limb getting here, and you're pissed that I'm late? I told you not to get your shorts up your crack." "Of course I'm not pissed. I was just worried, that's all. I'm sorry if I came off sounding like a jerk."
"Where'd the flowers come from? You buy those for me?"
"You like them?"
"Sure, but it's a lot of money for 30 minutes max."
She tossed her purse on the chair and slipped off her heels, which she kicked to one side. "That's all the time you have? I thought you said an hour."
"That's right. I got an hour, and now it's half gone, so don't hassle me, okay? We've got better things to do."
She began peeling off her clothes, dress, panties. She unhooked her bra, letting her breasts swing free. He couldn't pinpoint her mood. Under the casual manner, there was an edginess he didn't like. He waited for mention of the car, but she didn't say a word. She might be uncomfortable expressing gratitude. She was staring at him.
"Are you going to strip, or just stand there and look at me all day?"
He undressed quickly while Violet pulled the covers down and got into bed. They made love, but with not quite the ardor he'd experienced the day before. His performance wasn't all he'd hoped for, either, though Violet was nice about it, saying,
"Oh, quit fretting. Everybody has an off day. You're fine."
Afterward, she swung her feet out of bed and sat up. Despite his reassurances, he was wary, wanting to make it up to her. He put his arms around her from behind, nuzzling her hair, kissing the smooth skin in the middle of her back. He could feel himself coming to life again, where it counted.
"Check this," he said.
"Quit slobbering. You're getting on my nerves."
Teasingly, he tugged on a strand of her hair.
"So, how does it feel to have your very own Bel Air?"
That brought a smile. She said,
"Good. It's great.
When Foley came home this morning, he parked it out in front and had me look through the window. I could hardly believe my eyes."
She made it sound like Foley deserved the credit.
Chet would have kidded her about it, but he sensed that under it all, she was depressed.
"Hey, Henny Penny, what's wrong? Has the sky fallen in on you?"
"I'm fine."
"I know you better than that. What is it?"
"I just don't see how I can keep doing this."
Foley and I got into this huge fight last night, and the fucker tore up the house. It's like he can sense something's off. He hasn't figured it out, but it won't take him long. Once he picks up the scent, he's a regular bloodhound.
Has he said anything?
No, but there's this look in his eye, and it's scaring me to death. I'm skating on thin ice. One wrong move and...
What?
I don't know, but something bad.
Oh, come on. It can't be as serious as all that.
Easy for you to say.
He felt a whisper of fear. So, let's take a little break until he calms down again. Tomorrow's a holiday. I have work to do anyway, so there's no way to meet. This weekend you can pal around with him, go to the fireworks, take a picnic supper, do whatever you have to do. You'll have him eating out of your hand.
Oh, sure. Make light of it, good old Violet. Just hang out and jolly him along. Kiss his ass, suck his dick, anything to pacify the guy who's been a maniac from birth.
I wasn't making light.
Well, you don't have to live with him. You don't know what he's like. You're not the one he's busting in the chops every other day. Look at this. I still got a bruise from where he threw a friggin' coffee pot at me.
So why not leave?
And go where? How far do you think I'd get?
As far as you like. If it's a matter of money, I can help you out.
It's not money, Chet. Is that all you think about?
What then?
Shit. How can I make myself clear? It's just this feeling I get, like I'm in this alone. Who cares about me, right? In this town, I'm dirt, lower than the low.
I care.
Uh-huh. I'm serious. I care deeply about you. I know what you care about. Getting laid.
Now, wait a minute.
I'm just kidding you, okay? I'm trying to lighten up. What good's it ever done me to feel sorry for myself?
Violet, I'm on your side. That's the point I'm trying to make. I've been thinking about it, and it's not a good idea for you to stay under his roof. So what occurred to me was finding you another place to live.
Yeah? Well, not to worry. I'll figure it out.
But why won't you let me help when I'm seriously concerned?
Come on, Chet. Seriously concerned? You think I don't see what's going on? This isn't about me. This is about you and what you want. These past 2 days you haven't asked me one thing about myself except do I use birth control. Now how's that for concern? Like you're such a stallion I might get knocked up and ruin the rest of your life?
He could feel his face go blank. She caught his look and relented.
Sorry. I didn't mean that. I don't even know what I'm talking about. Why don't we just chalk it up to that time of the month?
Is that it? Why didn't you say so? Come here.
Would you quit with a phony tone of voice? That's not going to solve my problem. Don't you get that?
She got up and paced once across the room before she sat down again. She leaned forward with her elbows on her knees and put her face in her hands. She made a low, exasperated moan.
You're not hearing me, but it's my fault. I'll take all the blame. I should have made myself clear. What's going to keep me safe, Chet, is to stay the hell away from you. You're a nice guy and a good egg, but when it comes to screwing around, you're an amateur. If I'm in jeopardy, which I am, it's because of you.
But that's what I'm trying to say. I can get you out of here.
No, you can't. Look at you, goofy about me and all goofy for love. You think I'm the answer to your prayers, but I'm the quickest road to hell. I know you don't want to hear it, but I'm telling you the truth. You can't live this way with all the sneaking around. It's not in your nature. Basically, you're a decent man, which means you'll miscalculate. You'll make some stupid mistake, and there goes my ass. I'm better off calling a halt to it right here.
You don't mean that.
You see, that's what I'm talking about. You're not listening to me. You're not only putting me in the path of a train, you're tying me to the tracks. If you care, if you love me so much, why don't you give me a fighting chance and keep the hell away? I can manage Foley, but not with you bumbling around. Because here's how it's going to go. One night you'll walk into the moon with a bullshit grin on your face. Foley will take one look at you, and he'll know everything.
Then, guess who's dead meat? First me, then you, then him.
That won't happen. He's never going to know. Violet, I talked to him this morning. He sat at my desk not even this far away. I swear he doesn't have a clue.
You want to know why that is?
Because it was about money, and him trying to get something out of you. Also, because right now, we've been together 3 days, and you haven't had a chance to screw it up yet, but you will. Wait, wait, wait. Let's just think. No need to do anything rash. Look, how about this? I can rent you an apartment in Santa Teresa, under a fake name. You don't like that idea? We'll take off together and settle someplace else. I'd do that for you, I swear. She smiled and shook her head.
That's your solution? You got a great imagination. I gotta hand it to you.
She found her brassiere and hooked herself into it. She bent over and maneuvered her breasts, arranging each in its cup. She retrieved her underpants and stepped into them. She settled her dress over her head and zipped herself up. This was a strip show in reverse. She came back as far as the bed table, where she took a cigarette from his pack and tamped it on her thumbnail.
Look at this joint. They don't even provide a friggin' pack of matches. Can you give me a light?
Numb, he flicked his lighter and watched her lean toward the flame, holding her hair out of the way. She took a drag, inhaled, and blew a stream of smoke at the ceiling.
Thanks.
She took the ashtray and her purse and went into the bathroom. Through the open doorway, he could see her putting on her face. He followed as far as the door and caught a reflection in the mirror.
You're telling me it's over?
That's right. No offense, but let's bail while we can. He was silent for almost a full minute, while he thought about the last 3 days. You did it for the car, didn't you? Her mouth came open, and she turned.
You said what?
This was all so you could get the car, and now that you have it, you're finished with me.
Are you saying that I fucked you to get a car?
Thanks so much. What kind of whore does that make me? You're the one telling me not to talk shit about myself and listen to the shit that comes out of your mouth.
I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
If you're so sorry, then why don't you quit pushing me around? Abruptly, she went back to her lipstick, following the outline of her mouth.
You want to be a bully?
Take a number and get in line. When it comes to abuse, Foley's got it all over you.
Are you crazy?
You're crazy. Don't stand there bragging about how bad the guy treats you. I came here prepared to offer you a life.
Listen, Buster, I have a life. Might not look like much to you, but I'm doing the best I can, so don't you condescend to me.
Violet, don't. He tried to speak, but his throat closed and his voice cracked.
Jesus, Chet, be a big boy about this. It's been great, but let's face facts. It's sex. Right now it might be firecracker hot, but how long does that last?
In 2 months, it's gone. So don't make more of it than it is. You're not going to run off with me. You're full of shit. Chet took the last drag of his cigarette and flipped it out the window. He took one more pull from his flask and put that away. The tractor and flatbed, deck empty now, passed him again, heading back toward the 166. On the Tanner property, the bright yellow bulldozer sat with two others, looking as big as a tank. He hadn't been on a bulldozer since he was 18 years old, that ball-busting summer before his father had been killed. He'd worked construction, thinking he could set aside some cash for his freshman year of college. Nowadays, the union trained guys to operate heavy equipment, but in those days, you got on a dozer, fired it up, and hoped you wouldn't drive yourself into a ditch. He turned the key in the ignition and released the T of the emergency brake. He made a U-turn across the two lanes of deserted road. What he'd been through with Violet was the equivalent of a 3-year affair compressed into 3 days. Beginning, middle, and end. Over and out. He couldn't help thinking she'd made a bigger fool of him than he knew. He'd been set up, duped. She wanted the car, it was obvious now, but she'd played him well, and he half admired her finesse. She crooked her little finger, and he'd scampered after her, as frisky as a pup. He didn't feel it yet, the shame, but he would very soon, once the liquor wore off. He knew his humiliation was commiserate with his joy, but the joy had been fleeting, while the rage would burn at his core like the fire in the bowels of a coal mine, year after year. What wounded him was knowing she felt none of his pain. Now every time he saw the car, every time Foley made a payment, he'd cringe, feeling powerless and small. He'd go home to Livia, and that would be that. His life had been barely tolerable before, but what would it be like now that he knew the difference? At the house, he pulled into the driveway and put his car in the garage. Mentally, he shook himself off, struggling for control. He had a part to play. He couldn't let Violet ruin his home life as she'd ruined his work. He let himself in the house. The hall smelled of cabbage that had cooked half a day. He wanted to weep. He couldn't even look forward to a good meal at home. Livia, with her heavy hand and glum notions about food, served nearly inedible fare. Mackerel loaf, creamed chicken on waffles, tapioca pudding that looked like a clot of egg-infested mucilage spawned by a fish. He'd eaten it all, every variation on a theme, sometimes too frightened to inquire what it was.
"Daddy, is that you?"
"Yes." He peered into the living room. Kathy was sprawled on the couch, her heavy legs flung over one end. She wore white shorts and a T-shirt, both inappropriate for someone her size. She had a strand of hair in her mouth, and she was sucking on the end while she watched television. The Howdy Doody show. Talk about a waste of time. A cowboy marionette with freckles and a flapping mouth. You could even see the strings that generated his movements, his wobbly boots dangling on tippy toe as he pranced across the screen. Chet took off his sport coat and hung it on a peg in the hall. What did he care if the shoulder got pulled out of shape? He undid his collar button and loosened his tie. He had to get a grip. But 15 minutes later, as he was sitting down for supper, Livia made a half-assed remark, saying how ridiculous it was that the South Korean president, Syngman Rhee, called on Christians and non-Christians to pray for peace. He stared at her, instantly incensed. "You think it's ridiculous the war might come to an end? After we've lost 33,000 U.S. troops? Where the hell is your head? Rhee's the guy who released 27,000 North Korean POWs less than 2 weeks ago, sabotaging armistice talks. Now he's softened his position, and you want to sit there sneering at him?" Livia's lips tightened to such an extent he was surprised she could speak.
"All I'm saying is there's no point in non-Christians praying for peace when they don't believe in God."
"Non-Christians don't believe in God? Is that what you think? Anyone who doesn't go to your personal church and worship your personal deity is some kind of heathen? Livia, you can't be that idiotic." He could tell she was offended, but he really didn't care. Cheeks stained with indignation, she snapped his dinner plate on the table in front of him with a force that nearly cracked it in two. He looked down at the meal, which consisted of a main dish and a side of cabbage that had boiled so long all the color had cooked out. He pointed to the entree. "What's this?" Livia sat down and arranged her napkin in her lap.
"We're having International Night, the first Friday of every month. Kathy prepared the dish, and I think it's lovely."
"It's Welsh rabbit," Kathy said happily, already lifting a fully loaded fork to her lips. "Welsh? There's no such place as Welsh. Are you out of your minds? This isn't rabbit, it's cheese goo on toast."
"Would you sample a bite before you judge? Or is that too much to ask after Kathy's worked so hard?"
"This is shit. I can't work a full day and sit down to a meal like this. There's no meat."
"Please watch your language. There's a young lady present."
He pushed his plate back.
"Excuse me."
He left the table and went into the downstairs powder room, where he pulled out his flask and downed the remaining vodka in 6 swallows. It wasn't nearly enough, but maybe he'd manage to survive the next 15 minutes without going berserk. He returned to the table and began to eat, trying to imagine how normal men behaved. Husbands all over America must be sitting down to dinners just like this, with wives and daughters like the two he faced. How did they do it? Making small talk. He could do that. Clearly there was no point discussing world peace. He glanced at Kathy, not looking too closely, as she tended to chew with her mouth open. He said, "I saw your friend today."
"Who?"
"Liza."
"Oh."
She was so intent on stuffing her face, he wondered if she'd heard.
"Whatever happened to her?"
Kathy flicked him a look.
"Nothing. Why'd you say that?"
6 months ago, the two of you were like Siamese twins, joined at the hip. She'd dump you or what?"
"No, Dad, she didn't dump me."
"Then how come you don't see each other anymore?"
"We do, all the time. She was busy today. Is that against the law?"
"She didn't look that busy to me, unless a fancy lunch downtown counts."
"Liza didn't have lunch downtown."
"I thought today was her birthday. Didn't you say something to that effect here at dinner last night?"
"So?"
"So nothing. I thought she'd be spending the whole day with you."
"We talked on the phone. She said her mother's been sick and might even be contagious, or she'd have come right over to celebrate."
"Oh," he said, drawing the word out. "Well, maybe that explains it."
"Explains what?"
"What she was doing all dressed up with Violet Sullivan. The two had their heads bent together over shrimp cocktails."
Kathy put her fork down and stared.
"They did not."
"Yes, they did." "Mm-hmm. Yes, indeedy."
"Where?"
"The Savoy Hotel. The tea room's on the ground floor. I saw 'em through the window."
Livia said,
"Chet, very funny. Ha ha. And where's Daisy all this time? Did you forget about her?"
"She was sitting right there with a big bowl of buttered noodles she was slurping through her lips."
"You're just saying that to bug me because you're in a bad mood. Liza might have gone out, but it had nothing to do with Mrs. Sullivan."
"Why don't you ask her and see what she says?"
"Chet, that's enough. I can't call her again. I just talked to her. She's taking care of her mother, who's extremely ill."
"Okay, fine. If that's the way you want to play it, I'd feel bad if things went sour between the two of you. That's my only concern."
Kathy retreated into silence. Meanwhile, Livia sent him dark, meaningful looks that suggested a serious dressing down to come. Chet didn't intend to stick around for that. He wiped his mouth on his napkin and tossed it on his plate. He got up, working to control the urge to run. He could feel the spite rising in his chest. What the hell was wrong with him? He was never going to get back at Violet by making trouble somewhere else. Why put his daughter at odds with her best friend? The pettiness of what he'd done only fueled his rage. He thought he was close to madness, irrational, erratic, out of control. He took his sport coat from the hook and shrugged himself into it. Livia had followed him into the hall.
"Are you going out?"
"Yes."
"But I'm expecting company. This is my canasta night. The girls are going to be here at 8. You said you'd take Kathy and go somewhere."
He walked out the front door and slammed it behind him, so choked with fury he couldn't utter a word. Chapter 19. I went back to the motel office and borrowed Mrs. Bonnet's phone. I contacted the sheriff's office to report the incident and was told they'd send someone out. I then called Southern California Automobile Club and requested assistance. While I waited, I called Daisy's house, and Tanny answered the phone. She said Daisy had already left for work. When I told her about my tires being slashed, she was properly outraged.
"You poor thing! I can't believe someone would do that to you."
"Personally, I'm thrilled. I mean, on one hand, I'm peeved. I hate to be without transportation, and buying 4 new tires is the last thing I need. On the other hand, it's like hitting all 3 cherries on a slot machine. 3 days into the job and somebody's already nervous as a cat."
"You don't think it was vandalism?"
"Absolutely not. Are you kidding?
I grant you my car's conspicuous in a parking lot full of trucks,
But the choice wasn't random. This was supposed to be a warning, or possibly punishment, but I take it as a good sign.
Well, your attitude beats mine. I'd be raising 6 kinds of hell if somebody slashed my tires.
Shows I'm on the right track. Which is what?
I have no idea. But my nemesis must think I'm close to figuring it out.
Whatever it is.
Right. Meantime, I need the name of a garage if you know someone good.
You forget my brother's in the business.
Ottweiler Auto Repair in Santa Maria. At least he won't gouge you on the price.
Great. I'll call him. What about you? What's your day looking like?
I'll be out on the property with a couple of guys. If I were so minded, I could be clearing brush for the rest of my life. I'm meeting with a contractor at 11:30, but you're welcome to come by.
Well, let's see how long it takes me to get my tires swapped out. If everything goes smoothly, I'll stop and pick up some sandwiches and we can have lunch.
Tell Steve I sent you. That'll surprise him for sure. Better yet, I'll call him myself and tell him you'll be in.
Thanks. A sheriff's deputy arrived at the Sunbonnet within 30 minutes, and he spent an additional 15 minutes taking photographs and filling out information for his report. He said I could pick up a copy to forward to my insurance company. I couldn't remember the amount of my deductible, but I'd doubtless end up paying for them myself. Shortly after he left, the tow truck arrived, and the driver loaded my car onto a flatbed truck. I hopped in the cab with him, and we covered the 15 miles to Santa Maria without saying much. While the car was being unloaded, Steve Ottweiler appeared and introduced himself. He was 7 years Tanny's senior, an age spread that seemed to favor him. According to social standards, other than my own, a man at 50 is just starting to look good, while a 50-year-old woman is someone the eye tends to slide right past. In California, cosmetic surgery is the means by which women stop the clock before the sliding begins. Lately, the push is to get the work done earlier and earlier, age 30 if you're an actress, before the slippage sets in. I could see the strong family resemblance between Tanny's brother and their father, Jake, whom I'd met the night before. Steve had the same height and body type, lean and muscular. His face was broader than his dad's, but his complexion was the same sun-stained brown. I purchased 4 new tires, taking his advice about which brand I should buy, that being the one he had in stock. We sat in his office while the mechanic put my car up on a rack and started loosening lug nuts. Currently, Steve Ottweiler was the only person in the area I didn't suspect of slashing my tires, primarily because this was the first opportunity I'd had to piss him off. Somewhere in the last 2 days, I'd stepped on some toes, but I hadn't stepped on his, as far as I knew. I said, "You were, what, 16 in Violet Sullivan's day?"
"I was a junior in high school."
"Did you know Liza Mellencamp's boyfriend?"
"Ty Eddings? Sure. Though more by reputation than anything else. I knew his cousin, Kyle. They were both a year ahead of me, so we didn't have much occasion to interact. Actually, I'm not sure anyone knew Ty that well. He transferred in from East Bakersfield High School in March of that year. By the time July rolled around, he was gone again."
"Somebody told me he left the same weekend Violet did."
"No connection that I know of. They were both troublemakers, but that's about it. He'd been kicked out of EBHS and sent to live with his aunt in hopes he'd mend his wicked ways. Guess that idea flopped."
"Meaning what?"
"Word had it that he'd taken up with Liza Mellencamp, who was all of 13. The year before, he'd knocked up a 15-year-old girl, and she'd ended up dead from a botched abortion. Ty was accorded outlaw status, very cool in those days."
"He wasn't disliked or avoided?"
"Not a bit. We were all big on drama back then. Ty was regarded as a tragic hero because everyone thought he and the dead girl were deeply in love, and her parents had forced them apart. He was Romeo to her Juliet. Only, he came out of the deal a lot better than she did."
"But is it out of the question that he and Violet might have gotten together? 2 black sheep?"
"Well, it's always possible, though it doesn't seem likely. Violet was in her 20s and married to boot, so she hardly registered with us. We lived in a world of our own. You know how it is. The big event for us was 2 classmates who got killed in a car accident. Violet was a grown-up. Nobody cared about her.
Liza was the one I felt sorry for. I don't wonder, I said. I talked to her yesterday, and she said she was crushed when Ty left town. What was that about? The story I heard was Ty's aunt got a phone call from someone who told her he was fooling around with another underage girl, namely Liza. That was Friday night. The aunt turned around and called his mother, who'd flown to Chicago for a wedding. She got back to Bakersfield late Saturday night and picked him up first thing Sunday morning. You'd think he could have gotten word to Liza. She was dumped without so much as a buy or leave. I guess good manners weren't his thing. What happened after that? I asked, but she wasn't happy about the question, so I left it alone. Things went from bad to worse. Her parents had divorced when she was 8. She'd been living with her mom, essentially without supervision, since her mother drank. When her dad got wind of her relationship with Ty, he flew out from Colorado, packed her up, and took her back to live with him. Of course, that went nowhere. The two didn't get along. She hated his new family, and she was back the next year. No big surprise. You take a kid like her, used to freedom, and she's not going to react kindly to parental control. How'd he hear about Ty if he was in Colorado? He still had contacts in town. So she ended up living with her mom again? Not for long. Sally Mellencamp died in a house fire the next year, and a local family took Liza in. Charlie Clements was a good guy and didn't want to see her sucked into the foster care system. He owned the auto repair shop in Serena Station that I bought when he retired in 1962. Liza married his son. So everything connects. One way or another. It sure looks that way. Steve was called out to the service bay, but he urged me to stay where I was until my car was ready. His office was small and utilitarian. Metal desk, metal chair, metal files, and the smell of oil. Parts manuals and work orders were stacked up everywhere. I took advantage of the moment to review my index cards, playing with the information every way I could. A moment would come when everything would lock into place, she said bravely to herself. Right now, the bits and pieces were a jumble, and I couldn't quite see where any of them fit. It was Winston's confession I kept coming back to. For years, he'd kept quiet about seeing Violet's car. Now, I realized how lucky I was his wife was booting him out. Because he was pissed with her, all bets were off, and he felt no compunction about spilling the beans. If I'd talked to him a day earlier, he might not have said a word. It was a lesson I needed to keep in mind. People change, circumstances change, and what seems imperative one day becomes insignificant the next. The reverse is true as well. My VW was returned within the hour, my tires looking as crisp and clean as brand new shoes. In addition, I saw that someone had treated me to a complimentary car wash. The interior now smelled new, thanks to a deodorant tag hanging from the rearview mirror. I caught sight of Steve Ottweiler as I was pulling out and gave him a wave. Heading west on Main, I realized I wasn't that far from the neighborhood where Sergeant Schaefer lived. I took the next right-hand turn and circled back, parking out in front of his house, as I had on my earlier visit. When he didn't answer my knock, I followed the walkway around the side of the house to the rear, at the same time calling his name. He was in his workshop, and when he heard my voice, he peered out the open doorway and motioned me in. I found him perched on a stool with a miter box and clamps on his workbench. He'd cut lengths of framing, and he was gluing them together. Today he wore denim overalls, and his white hair pushed out like foam from under a black baseball cap. I expected to find you working on a chair. I finished that project and haven't yet started on the next. These days I'm so tied up with hobbies, it's lucky I don't work or I'd never fit it all in. What brings you this way? I thought I'd give you an update. I told him about my tires, my call to the sheriff's department, and my subsequent visit to Steve Ottweiler's shop. Sounds like you're making someone sweat. That's my take on it. The problem is, I have no idea who or how. Tell me what you've done, and maybe we can figure it out. I filled him in on my interviews, starting with Foley Sullivan, saying, I hate to admit it, but I thought Foley made a pretty good case for himself.
Sounding sincere is a specialty of his. What about the others?
Well, the people I've talked to fall into two categories. Those who think Violet's dead, you, me, and her brother Calvin, and those who think she's alive, namely Foley, Liza, and possibly Daisy. I'm not sure where Chet Kramer stands on the question. I forgot to ask.
Too bad we can't just put it to a vote, he said. I can see how Liza and Daisy ended up in the same boat. Neither wants to entertain the idea that Violet's gone for good.
Maybe we're the cynics, assuming she's dead when she might be alive and well and living in New York.
Can't rule that out.
I went on down the list, telling him what Winston had confessed about seeing Violet's car.
Schaefer said, I've been thinking about that car. A couple of us old retirees get together for dinner once a month and talk about the old days. I was telling them about you and what you're up to. The one fellow worked auto theft, and he said if the Bel Air landed in a junkyard, the VIN might have been stripped off and switched to another vehicle. You want to make a stolen car disappear, that's how you go about it.
The beauty of it is it then allows you to register a stolen car as salvage. You claim you bought some old clunker and fixed it up, and who's going